No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Together with my host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the discussion at 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. We have a great show today. We're going to talk to Derek McGinty, and we're so happy to have Derek on the show with us. He's a journalist, an award-winning interview and commentator. He got his start with his first job back in 1984 with WHUR in Washington, D.C., and at WAMU, Derek launched a nationally syndicated daytime talk show on national public radio. By the end of the century, he had been a correspondent on CBS and CBS Public Eye with Brian Gumbel and HBO Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. After 2 years in New York as anchor of ABC World News and World News This Morning, he came back to his hometown, Washington, D.C., yay, to anchor WUSA Channel 9's fledgling 7 p.m. local newscast. We're so happy to have him with us. Thank you for being here today, Derek, and we've got you here to talk about our old friend Mark Plotkin, talk about D.C. politics and some other things. So welcome to the show. And
well,
it's Maria.
So
I'm sorry,
yes.
Derek. Oh, okay. And Maria's with us. Thank you, Maria. This is Derek, and this is my co-host, Maria Sanchez.
Yes. So, good evening.
Hi, Maria.
Hello, Derek. Welcome, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Good to be here with you.
And, you know, let's start by talking about this great guy, Mark Plotkin. We mentioned last week that he had passed. He was 72 years old. He was an amazing advocate for D.C. statehood. That's how I knew him. And just a warrior for social justice in general. But why don't you talk about him for a while, Derek, because you knew him so well.
Well, I did know Mark pretty well. For 7 years, when I was at WAMU, we hosted the D.C. Politics Hour on Fridays. And, I could just tell a bunch of stories. But you know, we actually knew each other many years before that. And I'll tell you later how I first met Mark. It's kind of a weird story. But we hosted that show, and it had a chemistry all its own. You know, we had so much fun, and it came across well, and people would call in. I mean, we would be doing a show about some topic in D.C., and next thing you know, the chairman of the city council would call, or the mayor would call, or, you know, some other council member or some other person. It became sort of a must-listen, I think, if I can say that, for people who were interested in D.C. politics. And at the time, if you remember, D.C. politics is actually kind of boring now compared to what it was then, right? We had the control board came in to take over the city finances. We had all the stuff with Marion Barry, came back out of jail, he got reelected. I mean, it was just so many things were happening that, you know, it just made for a really interesting conversation every week, because you just never knew what would have gone down the week before, right, that we would have to talk about. It just was a really fascinating time. And I think people are probably glad D.C. politics is a little bit more boring now than it was then, right? But it did make for interesting talk.
And it does raise it, you know, it's not completely boring because we still have, you know, we still have our moments here in D.C.
Sure.
But,
sure.
You know, it's funny that you say that it was must listen radio, because that's exactly what the mayor, Muriel Bowser, said in a statement. She said, "Mark was never one to mince words and offered fair, poignant perspectives across media outlets, in particular tuning in to the show you mentioned, Derek, was must-listen radio."
Yeah, and it was because of Mark that it was that. You know, it was because of him. You know, his personality was so huge. And he, and as Mayor Bowser said, he would say whatever was on his mind. Didn't, you know, sometimes it wasn't the best thing to have said.
Wow. And I disagree with you. I think your personality had a lot to do with it, too. You are really a stalwart here in Washington, D.C. We love you, and you were certainly an important part of that.
That's very nice of you to say. Yeah, I appreciate it.
But right. You're right about Mark. He was a curmudgeon, right? I think if you looked at the Yiddish dictionary, you'd see a picture of him next to curmudgeon, because he was kind of gruff on the outside, but really a great guy on the inside.
That's how I always felt about him. I always felt that people who looked at how, you know, some of the things he would say or how he could come across, as you say, like a curmudgeon, would miss out on the fact that he was a warm-hearted person on the inside and he cared deeply about the city. I mean, I don't think – he wasn't even from here. Mark's from Chicago. But right. He loved Washington. I put his love for Washington, D.C. up with anybody's, and even us native-born people. You know, Mark loved the city, and he cared about the city, you know, government doing right by it, you know. And, you know, Mark would go – the reason it worked, Mark would go to every event during a week, right? He didn't care. He wasn't actually covering it except to be there so he could talk about it on the Friday hour, right? And he would show up to fundraisers late at night. He'd show up to council hearings during the day. He would go to everything. So then right. Friday would come, he could say, well, I was there, and this happened, and that happened, and this person was there, and they didn't have any people or whatever. And, you know, that's what made the show work. You know, Mark made it easy for me because he always, you know, brought so much knowledge and so much perspective from somebody who was almost an insider.
Well, that's why I've got Maria. She does
well,
the same
just
thing
gonna
for
say
me.
That I've been in radio it's over 20 years, and I've never heard of a weekly broadcast, especially a weekday weekly broadcast. How is that people were able to make the time or set aside the time or to carve out the time to listen to you?
You know, that's a very good question. I don't know. I mean, people would tell me they would listen in their cars. People would tell me that, you know, we were on at noon, so they would take their lunch hour to listen. People just found the time to listen. And we had a rebroadcast for a while at 8 at night. Maybe some people listened then. You know, but people did somehow, as you say, find a way
to make it possible.
To find that time, in the middle of the day, middle of the work day, to tune us in.
Yeah, because it's not like now where you can listen on demand or download and listen later.
Right.
We have portable devices and you can slip in your earbuds and no one needs to know.
This was the 90s, so, you know, the technology was definitely, you know, a generation or two old, right? So we didn't have a lot of what we have now to make it easier. So it wasn't as much of the on-demand world as it is now, right? So you had to make an appointment to listen, and for whatever reason people did. And you could kind of tell that people liked the show because, remember, now we were in public radio, so we used to fundraise off these shows.
Mm-hmm.
And that hour would raise a lot of dough, you know, because people were listening, people liked it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think part of the attraction there, Derek, I have to say, is that the show was real and that we're always, you know, I think people are always searching for that. They're searching for something that's real and honest and not, you know, just the formula TV or the formula radio. You turn on the TV and the radio and listen to the news and you hear the same thing over and over again. If you listen to, I try to listen to Fox and MSNBC and CSNBC to get different perspectives, but pretty much it's all the same. But you guys were very real.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that was much of the attraction.
I think there's something to that. I also think that we did not take ourselves that seriously. You know, there was a lot of laughter on that show. And you know, we had no problem poking fun at each other. We had no problem poking fun at our guests sometimes. And, that also, I think, was some of the appeal. You just never knew. And I just always felt like, you know, I looked forward to that hour every week because I knew we were going to have a good, we were going to have a good discussion, but we were going to have a good time. And I think that was really, if I could have kept doing just that after I left the station, I probably would have, you know, because it was just that much fun to do the show.
Well, did you share political orientations and passions?
I was a little different than Mark. Mark was, you know, Mark was all in for statehood. Mark was all in for representation and all this. You know, I was more the pragmatic one, right? I was saying, you know, Mark, I don't think statehood's going to happen. You know, I think, you know, I think you're wasting a lot of energy on that. I think, you know, going for representation is the ideal situation if we can get it. Obviously, it doesn't look like we're going to get it, but at least no time soon. But I always, you know, I was a little bit more practical than Mark. Mark was the, Mark had the more of the ideal. He was an idealist in a lot of ways, and I wasn't. I thought I was, like I said, I was more pragmatic. I think we were both, you know, pretty obvious that we leaned, you know, Democratic and supported the basic views of most of the politicians in this town. But, you know, we were a little different in that way.
Well, yeah, he was actually a dyed-in-the-wool statehood supporter. And he would tell, you know, he would tell me, I'm a statehood supporter. And if I said something he didn't like, he would, you know, he was quick to tell you exactly what he thought, right? And I was lucky enough, Mark invited me to speak before the Aspen Institute with him and Eleanor Holmes Norton. We did a thing at Constitution Hall with Ralph Nader. You know, he was a contributor to our constitutional convention. As you said, Derek, he showed up for everything, and he would show up when we were trying to write a new constitution for the district. And he made no bones about telling you exactly the way he felt about everything.
There's no question about that.
Let me just read for a second a few things that other people had to say about him. Tom Sherwood, who you know well, I'm sure, Derek, yep, a local broadcaster, said, "This is terrible news for his friends and associates, those he battled with over policy and those he embraced. No stronger friend and supporter of D.C. statehood will you find. R.I.P. Mark Plotkin." And Mark Seagrave said, "I'm heartbroken to report that my longtime friend and former colleague Mark Plotkin has passed away at his home in D.C. Mark showed me how to hold elected officials accountable. He was one of a kind, and he loved Washington, D.C. Yeah. And Jerry Connolly, who's a strong supporter of the district, congressman from Virginia, said, "So saddened to learn of the passing of Mark Plotkin. A longtime D.C. journalist and commentator, Mark was unsurpassed in his passionate advocacy for D.C. voting rights in Congress. I will miss our conversations and our friendship." People loved him. He was rough, but people
loved him.
They
did really like Mark. He definitely sort of earned that regard because of being who he was and how he operated. You know, it's funny. My first show with Mark, it did not go that well. I remember I was on, I had to do the show, you know, when I first started doing it, it was on at 8 to 11. And so at night, right? And so, I would come in and do the late night show. And Mark, he was on the first hour, so it was 8 to 9. And so on Friday, so he the first show he did, we were doing it, you know, nobody was calling. So we're talking. And, you know, it's about 10 minutes before the show's over, and I'm just out of things. We're both out of stuff to talk about, right? We've got nothing, and there's nobody calling, and there's nothing going on, and I'm giving out the number, and nobody's calling us. And so finally I said, you know, Mark, I had read that day or read at some point that Metro was going to raise the fares or something, and that was totally not in his purview of things to talk about. But I was so desperate, I said, "Mark, what about these Metro fares, you know?" And he stumbled. We both kind of stumbled around and somehow finished the hour. But that was so funny to both of us because it kind of became our little code. Like, if ever the show wasn't going well, we would say, "Better start talking about those Metro fares."
Well, you need that stuff, right? We've certainly been in that same situation, haven't we?
But Derek, coming from scripted news anchoring to talk radio is a huge leap, because as you said, when you're accustomed to either having a script or having a teleprompter or having something that's laid out for you to say versus talk radio, which can change at any second depending on the topic or the caller or the comment, that's a huge leap in terms of journalism.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. Let me just tell you that my first on-air job from 84 to 91, I was working at WHUR. And the last couple of years, I was anchoring the Daily Drum there, which was there, at the time was an hour-long news show, which no station has now. Like, no music station would have that now. But, you know, this is the 80s. And so, you know, they had a 20-minute-long segment every day that was, we called it the Insight segment, which was an interview segment. And, you know, and I started doing that. And that's where I kind of cut my teeth on being a sort of a live interviewer. My father, my late father at the time, was kept saying, you know, Derek, you're actually pretty good at that. You're better at that than you are at news anchoring. You should focus on being an interviewer. And I, you know, resisted him at first. I was like, ah, Dad, you don't know nothing about this. This is my job, you know. But, you know, he was kind of right. And so the more I did it, the more I began to feel like, because even at the station, they were two of us anchoring the show, but they began to give me sort of the lead on the interview segment. And I kind of began to say, I can do this. And so I applied for the WAMU job, and, you know, through a series of very fortunate events, I was able to get that job. And that's where I began to grow into being a better interview and doing talk radio. But I had done a little bit of it. I'm telling this story just to say I had done a little bit of it before then, so that I wasn't a complete rookie when I got on the air, although I had to grow a great deal in the first couple of years I was on that job, no question about that.
Because it's interesting that I've had colleagues when I was starting up and cutting my teeth, especially who did public affairs, for example, which is where I started,
right,
that they would script the interview in advance with the questions that they were going to ask, which I think always leaves the spontaneity out of it. Because as we all know, when you have a conversation with somebody, you don't really know where it's going to go.
Right.
Because based on the answer to a question, you might take it to a whole nother level or an entirely different direction, because that's what the comment or the remark takes you to.
Totally agree. And as a matter of fact, the way I used to do it was when I was doing an interview, we would tend to do 2 1-hour interviews in our 2-hour show. And when I was doing an interview, I'd write up maybe 10 to 25 questions or 15, 25 questions for the guest. But I would judge how well the interview had gone by how little I ended up looking at those questions.
Right, if I
needed to have something to start it off, right? So I would do an intro, and I'd have a first couple of questions just to get things going. But if it was a good conversation, I wasn't looking at the questions, right? Like you say, the conversation just went where it wanted to go. And I always felt like that was what was people were listening for, was a genuine conversation, and you know, and people just giving their, you know, their ideas and thoughts. And it was, I tried to make it very little about me, right? Not about my ideas, but about the guest, because they were always, I thought, more interesting than I was. They were someone who had written a book or someone who had done something interesting, or a politician or whatever. So it wasn't about what I thought. It was what they thought. And that's how I kind of tried to run it. It was about what Mark Plotkin thought, right? Because he never – Mark could talk now. He didn't have any shortage of things to say.
Opinions.
Exactly. No shortage of opinions. Oh, Mark was so funny.
And he never shied away from giving you his opinion.
He did.
No matter who you were.
So let me tell you how I first met Mark Plotkin. It was back in the 80s, and when I was working at WHUR – and back then, there was a Ward 3 council member by the name of Polly Shackleton. I'm almost certain that she passed on by now. And Polly, you know, was very beloved and popular. She'd been there forever. But she was retiring from the council. And so I had the bright idea, remember now, I'm about 25 years old, to do a story on who she thought would be a good successor. Because there was a few people running, including Mark Plotkin. And so I went to her. I said, let me do an interview with you. Who you think should succeed you? Who's the best person? And I did not know at the time that she wanted Jim Nathanson to be the next councilman. She had endorsed him. But I did the interview as though it was sort of like that she didn't have a horse in the race, right? I just did it like a straight news interview. Polly Shackleton says this person should be the next person. And Plotkin called the station and complained bitterly that Polly, this is Polly's person, and I had treated her like she was being, you know, objective and da-da-da-da, and dang it. And my news director made me go interview Plotkin to get his side of the story. And so that's how we first met. It wasn't necessarily under the best of circumstances, but Mark was cool, and he was a good sport, and we did the interview, and it was fine, and you know, actually ran into him because my news director at some point decided he'd be a good political analyst for us. So he joined us to talk politics many times over the years at WHUR. So I kind of knew him before I even got to WAMU.
Well, you know, and isn't that funny? That's not far off from how I met him. I had a political consulting firm at the same time in the 1980s, and I had a partner, and we both did national politics. We mostly did presidential election, but I did a little local stuff from time to time, and he did too, but his stuff was in Annapolis. So he called
me. Okay.
He was in state government in Annapolis doing communications work. And he called me one day and he said, I got this guy and he's running for city council. I don't know how he got referred to me, but he needs some direct mail and some other stuff. His name is Mark Plotkin, and he's running for, I don't know, city council, mayor. I don't know what he's running for. But could you call him and you take this for me and we'll just bill it through your company and blah, blah, blah. So I call Mark, right? Of course, he's a pain in the rear end because he's running his own
campaign. I have no doubt in my mind that he was a pain in the
rear
end.
And he's calling me at midnight. He's calling me at midnight, wanting to make changes on Sundays at midnight, changes to the letters. And I'm like, Mark, they're printing the letters. And, you know, and so we got the little direct mail done for him. And of course, he did the one thing that every political consultant loves in the world. He paid his bills. And it's something you always worry about, right, with local guys, whether they're actually, and there's always a lot of money. There's postage and printing and all sorts of things, direct mail. But he paid them all. And then I was done with them. I'm like, oh, thank God. And I didn't run into him again until I started working on statehood. And, you know, he was just such a stalwart. And as you say, he came to everything. And he was great. He was a mentor for me. But a mentor, like, in the truest sense of the word, like a parent almost. You know, he didn't tolerate bad behavior. He wasn't anybody that was going to blow sunshine up your skirt. And if he didn't like what you were saying, he was the first one to tell you that.
In no uncertain terms,
right? He didn't say, well, I think you should do such and such. He'd say, you're wrong. You shouldn't have said this. You should say that, you know. I mean, he would scold you. But in a way where you always understood that underneath it all, he liked you and appreciated you wanted to help.
I totally agree. And I think that, you know, Mark's, you know, what does Shakespeare say? Your greatest strength begets your greatest weakness. Mark did not have a filter, right? He had no filter or very little. So he's going to say what he thought. And sometimes maybe you shouldn't do that, right? But he was going to do it. And so that made him popular. I think that was his strength. I think that's what made him effective as a commentator. But I think that, you know, when he rubbed some folks the wrong way sometimes, it was also, you know, you could just say, hey, just tone it down just a minute, you know, but he couldn't really. He didn't really have that. He did not have a volume control like that. He was going to say what he thought and at what volume that he was going to say. Really pretty much one volume.
Right. And, you know, and now I have to share my favorite Mark Plotkin story. He invited me to speak in front of the Aspen Institute with Eleanor Holmes Norton. And, you know, he and Eleanor were friendly combatants, right? They were always at each other. In fact, I remember that he introduced us. And the first thing he said was, I usually say hello to the people that voted for me for city council, but I don't see any here today. And Eleanor took the mic from him and said, they're both dead, Mark.
That's a good one.
Yeah. And then at another point, he went and he gave a speech as part of a question. Now, you know this, Derek. This happens all the time in public forums where somebody goes to ask you a question, but really they're not asking you a question. They're giving
they
you
want
a
pontificate.
Right. Yeah. So he was doing that, and Eleanor said something, and he said, hey, I'm the moderator. And Eleanor again took the microphone and said, then shut the hell up and moderate. So that's how they work. But this is the best part.
That is hilarious. Those are great stories.
He introduced Eleanor, and he said, Eleanor Holmes Norton is our delegate. I don't call her Congresswoman because she's not a real member of Congress. She doesn't have a vote and blah, blah, blah. And I'm telling you, Derek, he goes on for 30 seconds about how, you know,
you're cringing while this is going on.
Right. And then he turns around to me and he says, and we have Senator Brown. And I said to my wife, I wanted to get up and kiss him on his bald little head. Because Eleanor looked at me like, what? I'm not a member of Congress, but he's our senator.
Yeah, so,
you know,
hilarious.
It was just a moment. And that was Mark, right? He just said what he thought. And of course, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who you know, too, Derek, is not shy in retiring.
No,
if you're going to give it to Eleanor, you better be ready to get it back. Because she's extremely brilliant and like Mark, doesn't hesitate to tell you exactly what she thinks. I just want to mention, by the way, that Kojo Nandi, who also does the Politics Hour now on Friday on WAMU, right? Also commented when we sent out an e-blast explaining that you were going to be on the show, wrote to the show and said that you are an amazing person you are the right person to talk about Mark because you knew him so well. And I think
that's very nice to say.
Yeah. And it's very, very true. But let's, you know, Maria and I, if we can digress here for just a second, Maria and I were supposed to talk a little more about the statehood hearing that we had.
The movement.
Yeah.
But
and
do you
know,
mind if before yeah. we go into that, because yeah. Derek has had such an illustrious career in and of
absolutely.
Itself, do you mind bringing our listeners up to speed about Derek, how you did what you've done, where you came from, and how it is that you have achieved this success in life? Because
well,
you're
yeah.
quite inspirational.
Well, that's
and tell us about
yeah,
what you're doing now
you
with your website
that.
And all. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
I said, and tell us what you're doing now with your website and everything.
Okay, where do I even start? I always feel like I was very, very fortunate in the things that went right for me in my career, and I got a lot of good breaks, and I was able to, you know, take advantage of them, I think, to the best of my abilities. You know, I'm born and raised here in Washington, D.C., as you know, went to public schools here for the most part, except for a couple of years at Archbishop Carroll, and went to American U, so I never left town, and I was just here, and I studied journalism. I decided to go into journalism after the late, great Jim Vance spoke at my high school, which I've told this story a billion times, and he talked about journalism and how great it was. I was 16 years old, and I heard him talking about it, and I never wanted to do anything else after that.
Wow.
And so I went to American U, studied journalism, and had an internship at ABC News in Washington then, and I ended up getting a desk assistant job, which is like the lowest of the low job you can get, mm-hmm. right? When I mm-hmm. first got out of school, I stayed
not
there
in the mailroom, though.
Yeah, it was not in the mailroom. It was in the newsroom doing stuff. You know, like you know, it's funny. I was getting lunch. I was getting you know doing things like that, answering phones. You know, just the stuff you do when you're the new person, right? And I was lucky enough to get a job at WTOP after that. As a news writer, and I did that part-time for a few years. I then got a job at UPI, the late lamented United Press International. I was a reporter there for a year. And then I got the WHUR job, and all these things were fortuitous, right? I mean, I just was in the right place at the right time. Something came along. I think anybody who's worked in this business for a long time knows you got to get some breaks, right? It's not just how good you are sometimes. You do have to get some breaks. You do have to be in the right position. But when you get them, you have to take advantage of them.
And right? have the talent.
And
HUR is affiliated with Howard University,
yes,
correct?
It is owned by Howard. And at the time, and still to this day, it's a commercial station. It's not like, you know, some university-owned stations are just, you know, training grounds for the students or whatever.
Right.
No,
they're 5 watts.
WHUR is a commercial station. Professionals work there. You know, people spend their whole careers there. You know, it's I was there for 6 years, and they had at the time had this huge news commitment. I mean, it was crazy. But by today's standards, you just would never see it. They had like 11 or 12 people working in a newsroom at an urban radio station. Yeah, I mean, you would just never see that now. But at the time, it was almost kind of sort of a, I want to call it a relic from a bygone era, right? You know, but they had held on to it, and they were very proud of it. And we tried to do good work, and I was fortunate enough to get in there while they were still doing that. And that gave me, you know, my first real on-air experience. And then from there, I was able to go to AMU. And then, you know, again, things kind of lined up. When I was at AMU and it was nationally syndicated for a few years, I got a little write-up in the New York Times. And
really?
Yes. A friend, somebody heard about my show, and somehow I got there to the New York Times, and they gave me a little write. It wasn't long. It wasn't big. Right, but you know the New York Times, right? So it got some attention.
Yeah.
It got some attention. Next thing you know, I was getting some calls from some networks, and things were happening. And I got an offer from. Ended up, I mean, I'm shortening the story greatly, but Bryant Gumbel was going to CBS, and I was, and I had gotten a little part time CBS gig while I was still doing radio, and Bryant liked my work, and so when he was starting his news magazine, The Public Eye, I had met with him, and he wanted to do it. Of course, now, Bryant Gumbel, you know, I had looked up to him my entire career, right? Because there was no other black face on network TV doing news that I could remember at the time, not as an anchor. He was on the Today Show, and he was, I just really very much looked up to him and admired him. So to get a chance to meet him and work with him and to become friends with him was a big deal. And so that worked, you know, worked out, and I was there for a couple of years, and I came back to D.C. I take that back. I left. They canceled his news magazine after a year, so I left CBS. I came back to D.C. and worked at WJLA for 2 years as an anchor reporter. Then I got a job as an ABC at ABC News in New York, where I moved to New York and anchored overnights there for 2 years. And then I came back to D.C., to take over WSA 7 p.m. News, and I stayed there for 12 years. In 2015, they told me they were going in a different direction, and I was okay with it, because that's how it works in this business. Sometimes, you know.
Love that,
something.
Yeah.
You know, we're going in a different direction. And I said, okay. And I realized that I didn't really want to leave town just to get another anchoring job.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, you know what, I'll stick around here for a while. And so I hesitated to say that I was retired because I still felt like I had some things I could do, you know. So I kind of do some things. I moderate some things here and there, write some commentaries, do some things like that. But I'm not really working full-time or anywhere near it. So that's about it right now. I'm enjoying it. Go ahead.
Well, where are you with D.C. for statehood?
Where am I? How do I feel about it?
Yes.
Yeah, how do you feel about it?
Okay, you know, this is always my argument with Plotkin. I always felt like, as a philosophical thing, I was never sure that D.C. would be better off as a state. I thought that we would be certainly better off with representation. But I didn't know if we'd be better off as a state. Would we get less money from the federal government? How would that relationship, you know, change? Would it change for the better? There's almost always unintended consequences when these things happen. Would we be better off? Would our lives be better if we were a state? And I was just never sure about that. I always figured that, well, representation was the thing we wanted, right? You wanted two senators and a voting House member. That's what I want.
Right.
You know, I don't really care if we're a state or not. And I don't know that most people here do care about that. They want representation, right? Being a state, I don't know if that helps us that much. Now, maybe that's the only way to get there now, right? Because the amendment to the Constitution that would have given us those representatives failed and is not coming back. So maybe a state is the only way to go. But every time, even when we've had a Democratic House and Senate, they haven't even scheduled a vote on statehood. So I got to wonder if really the powers that be are at all interested in D.C. being a state. And if they're not, then how is it ever going to happen? So, you know, I think the city has a lot of problems, and I don't know how many of them would be solved by becoming a state. You know, but I think there's a lot of things that can still be done that we could do to make the city a better place. And I think they're working on it. I'm not saying that the problems are insurmountable or anything like that. That's kind of where I am right now. I don't. And if you go around and ask people, I think most Washingtonians, I don't know this. I haven't taken a poll, but they don't spend much time thinking about whether we should be a state. I just don't think they do. I think they're worried about gentrification. I think they're worried about the cost of living in D.C. I think they're worried. Those are the things I think that the metro doesn't run very well. That's what they're worried about.
Affordable housing.
Affordable housing, which goes into the whole gentrification issue. You know, that's what I think people are worried about. I don't think they care. And I definitely know back in the 90s when we were talking about it, they didn't care that much.
Well, I got to say, there's a lot of truth in what you said, Derek, and that's why we have a rally for statehood and 300 people show up.
Exactly.
You know, and of the 300 people that show up, I know 250 of them by name. you know what I mean? Because it's the same people that show up for everything.
Right.
And I think you're right. I think they don't think about it. It's a big thing. And if you sit down and explain it to them, they go, "Oh yeah, that's a great idea." But I think you're right that people would be satisfied with two senators and a representative, voting representative, because you get everything you want. And I think one of the reasons that I push heavily for statehood is because you need something. You need a goal. You know, you need something. But if they came to me tomorrow and said, "Look, Senator, we don't believe in statehood, but we'll give you two senators and a representative," I would say, "Oh, yeah, let's do it." Because we would get everything right. We would get everything we want. And before I forget to say this, if you have not seen Real Sports with Brian Gumbel, you need to look at that show. Am I right, Derek?
It's agree with you on that. It's a tremendous show.
Yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating show. And I'm a sports fan because I sucked at every sport when I was a kid. So I live vicariously through
those that do.
Yes, and unfortunately, I think that Derek and I share something in common, and that is a love for what's turning out to be one of the worst football teams.
Don't even talk about the horrible Redskins.
0-4 today.
They're horrible.
Are you kidding me?
It's not watchable. I watched as much of it as I could today. It was horrifyingly bad. I mean, we're just really, really bad. What can you even say? There's no words to describe the horror of being a fan of this team.
Yes. And next week, to make it even better, our next game is against the New England Patriots. We're not 0-4. They're actually 4-0.
Just one of those things where you kind of think, maybe they won't play hard, like they'll think they had it made, you know, because it's the Redskins and they're not going to be fired up for us. That's the only hope that the Redskins have. But the Redskins are so bad, I don't even think that helps you. We can't do anything. The Giants are terrible, and they had one, you know, they had one game, they had won one game, and we made them look like all world. It's horrible. It's horrible.
I know. But on an up note,
trivia. Trivia, a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, his son, Kai Forbath, was the kicker.
I remember
kicker,
Kai Forbath.
Right?
He's a kicker, yeah.
I think he just, until last year, or last season, right? Yeah, so it was like, I didn't give a hoot about the Redskins, and then when Kai went there, I was like, oh, okay, maybe I'll watch a game or two, but not this season.
Derek just pointed out, in our brilliance, we replaced him with the guy who missed his first field goal from 20 yards out.
Oh, dear Lord.
Yeah, he's been there a couple of years now. He's been there a couple of years. Forbath was around for a little bit, and he did okay. Yeah. You know, he wasn't bad. He wasn't great, but he wasn't bad. You know, but you know, the kicker is not our problem, right? The kicker is
not our problem.
The kicker is not why the team's no good. Now, it's not like they're missing a field goal and they lost by a point. They're getting destroyed.
How big is your stadium?
The stadium is at
75,000.
It's over 70,000 or something like that. It used to be 85. I think they've taken out a bunch of seats.
Because of luxury boxes and press stuff and all. Because here in Los Angeles, they had at least 100,000, the stadium.
No, it's never been that big. It was like 85, but they couldn't sell them, right? So they started.
Really?
Yeah. So they started taking seats out. Because at one point, remember now, it used to be you wouldn't even be able to show the games unless they were sold out, right? You couldn't show the home games.
Now I'm old enough to remember that.
They changed that rule, right?
Yes.
When they kind of realized it doesn't make any sense not to show the home game since the vast number of people watching the team are watching from home, right?
Right.
Even if they're not in the stadium, you don't want to not show the game. That doesn't make any sense. So, but, they started taking seats out so they could have a sellout, right? And then now that they, you know, I think it's now that you don't have to sell it out to
to what? So what's your competition though? The Jets?
You mean in terms?
No, they're in a different league.
No. But I'm saying to put butts in seats. Where do the NFL players fans go?
Oh well,
if they're not going to DC, where are they going?
They stay home.
Or they stay home, yeah. When I was a kid, you couldn't get a ticket to a Skins game. I mean, they had a waiting list that was years and years.
Yes, they did. That was back when we were at RFK and had 55,000 seats.
55,000, right.
My father had two season tickets, and he didn't want to really go. He got tired of going. So my brother and I started, we were about 12 or 13, we started going to the games. My brother and I. So we went to all the Redskin games. Growing up, I went to RFK a million times to see, you know, a bunch until it got too cold, you know, and later in the year I wouldn't want to go in December stuff. But we went to a billion Redskin games. I felt very fortunate to have seen them when they were actually good, right? I mean, when it was fun to go, when, you know, it was a big deal to go. And then for a while, remember, it used to be there was a time when you couldn't show the home game that day at all, even if it was sold out. So they would show the home game the next day on Channel 20, right? So you would have to wait till the next day. I'm kind of dating myself, but I used to, you know, watch on Mondays. You'd watch the Redskins game on Monday, even though you knew what was going to happen because you wouldn't have seen it, you know. But now then they changed the rule that if it was sold out, you know, 24 hours in advance or whatever, then you could show the home game, and then the rest is history on that.
Derek, would you say that you had somewhat of a privileged upbringing?
I did. I would say so to a great extent. You know, I had two great parents. My father was in business. My mother was a college professor. And you know, so they were pretty successful. You know, education was huge at my house. Both my parents had graduate degrees. You know, it was. I guess I would have to say that I was very, very fortunate to have grown up in Upper Northwest Washington and had a very good situation. If I hadn't been as successful, I would have had no excuses. Let's say that.
Well,
or else
let me
there wasn't
you,
any room for that.
There was
before
no room.
Before we
that.
Get off sports, to save the reputation of Washington, D.C., I will say that our Mystics, who are in the NBA, the WNBA Finals, won today against the Suns 95-86. So we're very proud of the Washington ladies who are out there. But the Redskins. I'll tell you, Derek, I fell in love with the Redskins because I moved here when I was 12 years old, and I went into a bar with my dad, which you used to do in those days, right? My dad would take me into bars with him, you know, and I went into a bar and I saw this chubby redheaded guy kind of stagger out of the bar. And my father said, "That's one of the world's greatest athletes." And I was like,
"And it was
what?"
Sonny Jurgensen?
And it was Sonny Jurgensen.
Yeah.
And I watched a couple weeks later. I watched him throw like a pass, waddle back and throw a pass on a shoestring to a guy named Charlie Taylor.
Not Charlie Taylor, the great Charlie Taylor.
Yeah, who used to run like a gazelle.
Oh,
once
he was
he caught
amazing.
The ball, he was just amazing. It was just poetry in motion to watch him run. And he ran down the sideline for a touchdown. I'm not even sure the Redskins won that game, but I was hooked after that. I was like,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It's been a lifelong love affair, but a tragic love affair at times.
It was a time. You know, they weren't good when I first started. I grew up, like you said, I grew up here. My father was a Redskins fan, so, you know, I wanted to do everything he did, right? So if he was a Redskins fan, I was going to be a Redskins fan. So I watched the Redskins. But what was I going to say? You know, they didn't make it easy at first, right? But just when I started becoming a fan and understanding football at about the age of 11 or 12, that's when George Allen came.
Right.
And, you know, then they started getting better. And, they started winning. And George Allen, you know, the future is now. He traded all his draft picks for these really old players. And, I mean, it would never work now. But it worked then to an extent, right? And you know, it was fun to watch. That's when Sonny Jurgensen and Billy Kilmer and all those guys were here. Kilmer. Larry Brown, you know.
Another guy, Billy Kilmer, you know, who looked like when he wasn't playing football, he was probably a biker.
Right.
He was a tough kind of redneck guy. Riggins and all those guys.
And George Allen came from Los Angeles to go to the Redskins.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I remember his name. I used to be an NFL. Well, actually, I was an AFL fan because I was a Joe Namath fan when I was growing up.
When the
merger and all, and then of course the Super Bowl III when the Jets won, and I used to sit. My dad would take me to the Coliseum to watch the Los Angeles Rams play. Or I would sit in the family room with him and his cigar-smoking buddies and watch the game. I was the only female in the room. And to this day, a cigar represents something very sentimental to me because of the sensory memory of that. Yeah. But football, I just loved. I always have. Now I have a problem with the concussion thing.
Yeah, that's bad. That's bad. It's a bad situation.
Some of the behavior of the players acting badly. It's tough for me. I have a problem justifying it. It's just like animals in the zoo.
Me too.
I appreciate it, but I have a problem with it. Are they there for us, or should they be there for the planet?
Right. No, I completely understand the feeling. You know, I felt the same way about animals in the circus.
Yes.
You know, I felt like, you know, I'm enjoying the entertainment of it, but this don't seem quite right, right?
And I've got a story for you, Maria, about Namath. You know, Namath was Bear Bryant was the coach of the University of Maryland for 1 year.
No,
and
really? I didn't
Joe
know
Namath, one or two years, a couple years early on, and Joe Namath applied to the University of Maryland. And they wouldn't accept him because his grades weren't good enough. And some assistant coach at Maryland called Bryant at Alabama when he was coach at Alabama and said, "You need to see this boy." And of course, he didn't give a damn whether Joe could read or write if he could throw the ball. And so Alabama took him, of course,
and the rest is history.
Yeah.
People don't remember Joe Namath could run when he was young.
Yeah.
Joe Namath could run. He was fast and elusive and could do, you know, very athletic. Now he's kind of, you know, at the end of his career, his knees were bad and he couldn't do anything. But he used to be something.
But he still looked good in pantyhose. Right?
I remember
that's
that.
You're
really dating yourself by talking about that ad. You're really dating yourself when you bring that ad.
Yeah, I know. And you know what?
First celebrity spokesperson in the history of endorsements. Those two genres never crossed over until Joe Namath. He did Dingo Boots. He did Noxzema, the shave cream. Take it off, take it off, take it all off.
Wow.
He did the pantyhose. He defied. In fact, you would even almost say that he was in touch with his feminine side, if you will. Do you remember he used to have those full length, long mink coats?
Oh yeah, he did.
Yeah. He changed the way advertising in Madison Avenue started to present their products. Joe Namath.
Interesting. That is.
Well, you know that when I was a kid, and you might remember this, Derek, Ted Williams. Everything at Sears was Ted Williams' autograph. So it wasn't like Ted Williams' baseball stuff. It was bowling balls, basketballs, you know what I mean? It was like he was Sears'.
He was like their brand, huh?
Yeah,
like
he was their brand.
I will concede that I don't remember this.
I don't either.
Well, I'm older than the two of you, unfortunately. And, you know, I just have to say, since we talked about the Redskins, I have no refuge because I went to the University of Maryland, and the other day they got beat by Penn State 59-0.
Yeah, I heard about that game.
God. Yeah, I said, were they playing basketball? 59. Who gets 59 points in a football game?
Well, the UCLA game last weekend was similar. It was 60-something to 60-something.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time here, Derek, and thanks for being on the show. But I want to ask you before we leave, can you give people your website? Because I looked at your website and I thought it was very
interesting. It's fabulous. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's very nice.
Tell people what your website is.
It's easy. It's DerekMcGinty.com. DerekMcGinty.com. And, you know, it's there to be looked at. I haven't, you know, been organized as I should be in terms of keeping it updated all the time. But there's some commentaries on there, there's some blogs on there, and there's, you know, stuff like that. So if someone wants to go and see some of my, you know, sort of outside work, it's there to be viewed.
Well, I encourage people to do that. I encourage people to watch Real Sports. What's it called? Real Sports with
Real
Brian
Sports
Gumbel?
With Brian Gumbel. Yeah, it's on. It still airs monthly on HBO, so you can catch it, you know, several times during the month. And then these days, of course, you can probably stream it anytime you want on one of the websites,
YouTube or
HBO.
Yeah, and it's a great show. It really they go into the backstory about these athletes, and you know there's so many great stories in professional athletics, and you know I guess I relate to it because my dad back in the day, my dad ran a sales company, and he used to use Redskins who would work for him in the off season because back in the 1960s, if you weren't one of the stars of the team, you weren't making enough money, you know.
Right.
They were working
all the guys had second jobs. All the guys had
right.
second jobs, yeah.
And you know, I remember the most terrible story, a guy named Dave Francis, who was a friend of my dad's and worked for my dad. He was an All-American from Ohio State, and he was an amazing player, had an amazing career, came to the Redskins, got hurt, seriously hurt his first season, sat on the sidelines for a season, and then that was it. They cut him from the team because he couldn't play anymore. And he went back to being a gym teacher in Ohio because that's what he was trained to do, you know, in college. Wow. That's what a lot of them studied in those days, things like that.
You know, the kind of thing does happen. It's always tough.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jesse Jackson, when I worked for Jesse Jackson, he had a big program to try to talk kids out of sports because he said, you know, you can become a brain surgeon with the same amount of effort it takes to become a professional basketball player. You know, they only pick a handful of them every year, and your chances of playing in the NBA, you got a better chance of going to the moon probably. So he started a program to try to get kids into academics as well as sports, and that's a good idea. Well, Derek McGinty, thank you so much for being on our show. Thank you for your recollections about your friend Mark Plotkin, who was an amazing guy. We're going to leave tonight with a song by this is a little sentimental on my part. I thought of a lot of things we could. Usually we do a song to honor our guests, but this is for Mark. I just want to read before we leave something from Tim Cooper, who's an international lawyer who knew Mark. And he said, Mark Plotkin was an American original. He lived a life of principle, but above all else, he was a warrior for social justice. He gave us his all. And I think that's true. So we're going to leave you tonight with an oldie but goodie, long before the time of Derek McGinty. But this was on the top of the charts the year that Mark Plotkin graduated from high school. This is the Seekers with I'll Never Find Another You. This is for you, Mark. Thank you, Derek. Hope to talk to you again soon. And thank you, America. Maria?
And thank you to our listeners who always make us a priority in their lives. We appreciate it, and we're very grateful.
Okay, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, Derek. Capital of this
Give the people their right to vote.